This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning to you.
So today we are talking about a songwriter par excellence, a genius in the industry who's written so many songs that people, you know, hear and know from, you know, their whole life. This Magic Moment, Viva Las Vegas, you know, Suspicious Minds, you know, Save the Last Dance for Me, you know, Doc, you know, Pomus, and hardly anybody that our listener would know who he is. But by the time his daughter, Sharon Felder, we get finished with her, everybody will know who he is and why he's an important figure in the music business and why he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and why she's nominated for a Grammy Award for a compendium of his unpublished demo music.
Yeah, and which will be awarded tonight.
Yes.
February 1st.
Nominee for Best Historic Albums, You Can't Hip a Square.
All right, Arnie, we are back with my friend Sharon Felder, who is the Grammy-nominated producer, filmmaker, artist, estate executor, and head of the Doc Pomus Estate, and she's Doc Pomus's daughter.
You know, it's great to have you on the show. He is a legendary figure, as you know, in the music industry, and it'd be great to talk to you and unpack a lot of things about you, your father, the music, the documentary, the album, all these kinds of things that are going on. And it's great to have you with us to talk about all of that.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And this should be fun.
What led you, before we talk about your father, which is, you know, could be 20 episodes of a show because he's such an interesting, larger than life. I mean, literally, of many people that are described as larger than life, your father is larger than life. He's sort of like the Zelig of the music industry. Everything that happened during his lifespan, he was, you know, integral part of. That it's amazing. I watched the documentary and all I could say afterward was, wow, and how brilliant it was.
Thank you.
How did you tie your life into all of this, and rather than go off as lots of children do and, you know, and be totally, you know, disconnected from your family?
Well, Arnie, when my dad was alive, I mean, obviously, first of all, he was a great guy, so I loved him. So it wasn't like a chore, you know, to stay connected. Some people are estranged, you know, for different reasons. So I never had that problem. So that's thing one. Thing two, when he was alive, I wasn't so involved with his career. You know, I had my own life. I was a professional photographer. And as a matter of fact, I worked for a few years in the music industry, and I never even told people that he was my father because I just kind of wanted to make my own way. So that was a surprise to people when he died that they learned, you know, that we were
related.
Related, exactly. Yeah.
And you also, you know, taught at NYU and Fordham University. I mean, you had a lot of things going on.
Yeah, I did. And I was always drawing, painting. I've had some shows. I always did fine art photography. I have a MFA from NYU, an International Center of Photography. So I even taught in a nursing home for years. I've kind of ran a million different things. And my dad and I did things together in the arts too. Sometimes I occasionally sang little things for him. He liked how I sang, funnily, and he wanted me to sing on demos, although I was too shy, so I never did. But I was integrally involved in his life, but sure. And like witnessing more or less.
Sure.
Tell us about growing up, in Brooklyn, and you were born in Williamsburg. What was it like to be the daughter of a songwriter?
Well, I was born in Williamsburg in the apartment. My father got the apartment that his parents moved out of. So, and within a year of my moving in there as a baby, a gun was shot through my crib.
Jeez.
And so the neighborhood was transitioning. And so my dad was like, we're out of here. So I didn't actually grow up in Brooklyn. He bought the first house he could afford. He had like two records out, and he moved to Lynbrook, which is actually Brooklyn spelled backwards, reverse. And we got it in the suburbs. And yeah, so I didn't, until my parents were divorced when I was like 10, we lived in Lynbrook. And during the week, my dad kept a hotel suite at the Forest Hotel, which is where he lived in Manhattan, opposite the side door of the Brill Building. So it was like during the week, he worked at the Brill Building and came home on the weekends. And that's like during the heyday of all that great. I was born in 58, so like all that early 60s stuff was going on. And the Drifters would be at my house. Phil Spector slept at our house all the time, you name it. Dion was always sleeping over. It was that those were the people, the Coasters, the Drifters, Jerry and Mike, Lieber and Stoller. That was the world that I grew up in.
You mentioned Dion. You mean you let a guy from the Bronx come to Linwood and hang out with you?
Oh my God. I still talk to Dion. He's the greatest. I love
Oh,
Dion.
he was the great. He was one of the great original, guys in that
He's
period of
down in
time.
Boca, right, Sharon? He's in Boca.
He's in Boca. He divides his time between Boca and Lower Manhattan.
Exactly.
No,
He sang.
he's amazing. I know he loved Lou. Lou loved him. But yeah, no, Dion, and Dion recorded a lot of songs of my dad's, and I think my father was sort of a father figure to Dion. He
And
guided.
the most iconic one of the ones he recorded of that your dad wrote was A Teenager in Love,
Yes.
which transcends, generations. Every generation could relate to a song like that.
Yeah, and if you in the box set that I worked on, we play the original in sort of version of it, where the demo of it, where he's
Right.
called why it he it became Why Must I Be a Teenager in Love, but it was originally It's Great to Be Young and in Love.
Right.
Of course, my father said it's not great to be young in love. It's torture.
Yeah.
It's torture to be young and in love. So he turned the whole thing around.
Your dad died in 1991,
Yep.
and you started working on lots of things about him afterwards. Did you really know at that time, before he died, and learn afterwards how expansive his reach was in the music industry? Or did you know it all along?
I kind of knew it, but I was like, when I looked at all this, these boxes, this stuff, I was like, this is a massive amount of amazing stuff that we can't just put away in a closet and never deal with. So right away, I realized I wanted to honor him always. So the year after he died, I wanted to make a tribute album for him. So I produced a tribute album, which I was so grateful that Lou Reed is on that, and that's where
Right.
he does This Magic Moment. And I got Bob Dylan to, that was an amazing
Talk a little
lot.
bit about that. What was the.
That record, I wish it was still easily accessible. It's called Till the Night Is Gone,
Right.
which is on Rhino Records. Richard Foose, who owned the label, was really wonderful. And we decided that every artist was going to get like 20 grand. Imagine that, to do whatever they wanted. Like pick, no, I mean, we had to approve the song, but then they did
Right.
the track on their own. So actually, it's like, so we have like The Band, Solomon Burke, Rosanne Cash, Dion, Bob Dylan, Lou Reed, Dr. John, Aaron Neville, Irma Thomas, Brian Wilson. It was pretty
That's
unbelievable.
an incredible roster of
And a
artists.
diverse and a very diverse roster. And by the way, you can go on Amazon Music and see the playlist and then click on the songs and you can pull this every one of the songs. I've listened to them all
Oh, you
in the
have?
last week or so. Yeah, they will go back to the you may not be able to get the album or the a digital version, but you can go online and listen to every one of the songs, and when you listen to it, you'll see it was off the album. So they've recorded it somehow,
Oh, okay.
and you
Okay,
can get
good.
them all.
Okay, I didn't realize that. That's
Yep.
great.
And my favorite of all of them is the Aaron Neville's version.
Oh, Save the
Oh,
Last Dance for Me.
yeah.
We were in the studio with him when he did that. That he did. My father's really good friend Joel Dorn produced that, and Joel, we went to New Orleans to do that in the
Yeah, I mean,
studio.
Aaron Neville is one of those performers, and he's still alive. I don't know if he continues to perform, but in three notes, it's Aaron. Two notes, it's
That's
Aaron Neville.
right. Very identifiable. What an incredible artist.
So that was the first big project that you did after your dad's passing. And did Rhino come to you to do this, or how did that come about?
Gosh, I remember that I had a friend, Robin Lerner, who was friends with Richard Foos. It was like somebody knew somebody and reached out to R Richard, and Richard was excited. I right from the get-go, it was just Richard Foos and Rhino. I didn't even
Right.
deal with anybody else.
Quick
And
administrative question. Sorry, Arnie. Quick administrative question, but did you, when your father passed, was all of that worked out in advance that you would kind of be the one that would administer working with the publishing company, all of the songs and usage and how they would be used? Or is that something that over time developed? Like how did, because I know that could get messy at times.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of legal stuff. So my husband really immersed himself. He was going to law school. He was very, very good with he had a mentor. He's not a lawyer, but he quickly pivoted to do this. It became kind of like a cottage industry, the Doc Pomus world of the president of BMI was my father's lawyer early on. Ed Kramer, long dead, and Ed trained Will, my husband, to learn everything about renewals, revisions, everything we needed to know about the rights, or otherwise we would have lost everything. So he did it. I do not have that brain. It's not something I have the patience for. It's
Well,
very,
that's nice, though. That's nice that
oh
he
my
has
God.
that brain and you have a creative mind to kind of work together on those these things.
Yeah, there's a lot of minutiae. I don't know if you dealt with it at all with that kind of stuff in terms of like artist rights, and it's really
A little bit.
in the weeds, deep in the weeds, and it's hard. You could lose songs in a minute. The publishers were tricky. Yeah, and I mean, I know we didn't really get into the fact that the reason I know Scott is through the world of Lou Reed, and
Right.
Lou would go to my dad for advice all the time. Because
Right.
he been there, done that, seen this character, would say, oh, this guy's a schmuck, this guy, and
Right.
Lou was always like looking for truth because or feeling that somebody was ripping him off, and they always were ripping you
Of
off.
course. And Scott, you know this, but the Magic and Loss album by Lou Reed was dedicated to Doc Pomus.
Yeah,
exactly as a
No,
matter
so.
of fact, when my dad learned that he had lung cancer, and it was a very short window of time, but that we had with him. But Lou actually came to the hospital almost every day. It was really intense, and
Wow.
he was writing Magic and Loss right away. I could tell
Yeah.
that something was going on, and he was just absorbing it. And he
Right.
actually brought my father, because I'm preparing my dad's archive to go to a special library that I can't say until few weeks from now. It's happening in a few weeks, but this is going in it. You can't, it's a tape. You're not gonna be able to see this. This is a cassette tape that Lou brought to the hospital with Lou's handwriting for Doc, with love from Lou, of What's Good, a song that he wrote for my dad in the hospital. And we played it on the cassette player together. And the handwritten lyrics are all, in Lou's handwriting and everything.
It's
Wow.
crazy, but it's crazy. But
Crazy.
Lou obviously revered Doc Pomus. And I think Arnie, to your point, he revered him and acknowledged what an amazing songwriter he was. And so he was like a mentor to Lou. And I think when we started to put together the book with Lori a couple of years ago, The Art of the Straight Line, we identified the different mentors and teachers in Lou's life that really were guided him through his career. Andy Warhol. Well, started with Delmore Schwartz.
Right.
Andy Warhol, Doc Pomus. I mean, one of the key, milestones in his career.
Well, let me for our listeners, before we get down, continue to go down into the weeds, let me just back up to a little bit higher level to look down on this. Doc Pomus that we're talking about is a co-writer and writer of many, many rock and roll hits, from Teenager to Love, This Magic Moment, Sweets for My Sweet, for Elvis, Viva Las Vegas, Little Sister, Surrender, Suspicion. He wrote for Andy Williams, Can't Get Used to Losing You, which was his biggest hit, Turn Me Loose, and Save the Last Dance for Me. I mean, it was tremendous legacy. He also wrote over 1,000 songs,
Yeah,
and
we're still learning. We still find songs we never heard. I'm not joking.
really,
Oh,
yeah,
it's
wow.
unbelievable. It's
No,
really.
and then after he passed, he was almost immediately inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a songwriter, and then into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and then into the Blues Hall of Fame, because he had an early career being a white Jewish, disabled blues singer in New York City. We haven't even talked about the fact he spent a year in an iron lung when he was 6 years old because he had polio. He overcame tremendous obstacles, had a career that most people, couldn't imagine having. And he did this with so many things in against him at a time when it was very difficult to, to have that kind of achievement. I watched the documentary. One of the things that was, shocking to me, or surprising, and maybe it shouldn't have been, he heard one of his songs on a jukebox and called up the record company to ask whether he had any money coming to him, and he did. They never
Right.
even told him. And probably if he didn't call, they would have never given him $2,500.
Well, right. There was that song was Youngblood, which he
Youngblood.
wrote with Lieber and Stoller, and on his
Right.
honeymoon with my mom, he heard it on the jukebox. So he
Yeah.
called, and he they he was he didn't have much money at all. So he's
Right.
like, "Oh, I think I can get an advance," So that was
And
exciting.
he said 2,500 would carry him for almost a year back in those days.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
So for our listeners, this is, sort of the, overview of what a great man he was. He worked with Dr. John. Dr. John, he helped Dr. John get off of heroin. And at the had at the the he gave one of the eulogies for him, and talked about that. He's
At my dad's funeral, which was
yeah.
truly unbelievable, Lou spoke. And Lou mentioned at the funeral that Doc always wanted to take me to Katz's for some Knebelwurst, and as among other things, he said.
Right.
And Dr. John said, "I'll never forget this. It's emblazed in my brain. I stand before you, a scumbag dope fiend." And
Yep.
we're all like, "Oh, have you ever heard this at a synagogue at funeral?" And my father was not religious at all by any means.
Right.
And it was like, if it weren't for Doc Pomus ragging my ass, saying, "Get out into the real world, Mac, and get off of drugs." So
Yeah.
he the 'cause like yeah, so he Mac did it himself, but certainly my father annoyed the hell out of him about it.
One of the great one of the great vignettes that I visualized from the documentary was the admiration that John Lennon had for him, and the story about you
Oh.
and the in the bookstore with John Lennon.
It was actually a grocery
A
store. My sister
grocery store.
was in the bookstore, but yeah. So my grandmother, I was living with my grandmother who lived across the street from the Dakota.
Right.
You would see John Lennon everywhere back in the day, that day in that era. And I went into the grocery store, the Ruxton grocery store, and there was John and Yoko. And I knew that he'd been hanging out a bunch with my dad. And I pulled up the courage and I introduced myself. And he was so wonderful and warm. And he sang the entire Save the Last Dance for me in the grocery store in front of all the people. And I was overwhelmed and overcome. And I just had to like ease my way out of the store. I didn't even know how to cope with
That's a
it.
one. I was going to say that's a once in a lifetime,
Totally.
experience. John Lennon singing your dad's most famous song to you in a grocery store in New
You
York City.
imagine?
I can't imagine.
Crazy. What was it
Totally
like,
crazy.
Sharon? What was it like growing up to be the daughter of somebody well this well known, but then also for you to start discovering music too, right? You were kind of in a period where you were just, probably visiting clubs, seeing
Oh,
different
yeah.
music, really exploring everything that the city had to offer, and it was an amazing time.
Yeah, well, I mean, my parents got divorced when I was 10, so we moved back to Manhattan. I lived in Manhattan all my life. So
Got
I
it.
we sold the house when they got divorced, and so starting in the late 60s, I lived in the city. And so I often went to clubs with my dad even because I liked a lot of the same music he liked. And then, if I but he wasn't going to go to like the Academy of Music or wherever I liked the Kinks or Todd Rundgren. That wouldn't have been something he would want to go to. But I was, doing, but I would always go with him to Tramps or the Lone Star or, any number of clubs.
Right.
I really had, I always went out with him at night, starting from being a teenager.
You know, one of the other things that I wanted you to comment on was the fact that arguably the greatest lyricist of all time is Bob Dylan. Ask your father to write lyrics for.
Well, so Dylan was going through a period, where he was having, I think he was reaching out to different people, and his manager, Jeff, contacted my dad and said, Bob is going to send you a melody, see what you could do with it. And my father was a thought it was a joke, like
Right. I mean, it's Bob Dylan,
Bob Dylan. But anyway, so sure enough, Bob came to his house with one of his sons. And my husband and I were on our honeymoon. And I remember my father literally calls me and goes, Bob Dylan is coming over. And I was like, are you kidding? This is, it was such a big deal to my father. And I'm very close with Jeff Rosen, his manager, who I
right.
thought was like one of the greatest guys on the planet. And, yeah, so as a matter of fact, Dylan dedicated his most recent book on songwriting to my father,
Is
called
that right?
Yeah, it's called The Philosophy of Modern Song, and one whole page is just
That's
dedicated.
amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
It's like William Shakespeare asking for help writing something. I mean, it's incredible that he was that instrumental and valuable and viewed that way by so many diverse people from across a large spectrum of music.
By the way, did your dad maintain that wonderment all through his career where, like, he couldn't believe? I remember you saying when we were talking about Lou, he couldn't believe Lou wrote a song for him.
Yes, he was very modest. He really, don't forget, like, I don't think he had any concept of the impression that he made. I really don't. I knew, I don't think it really hit him. And don't forget, he wasn't like financially well off.
Right.
The royalties he went through, and you probably will touch on this, but he had to support us by playing poker.
Right.
So that was like a whole nother insane chapter of my childhood. That was
Right.
my teenage years. But I was just going to say that I have this insane story. So Jeff, like I said, is my dear friend, and I've never met Bob Dylan, and I know, he's reclusive or what, but I asked Jeff if he could get Bob to autograph the book, The Philosophy of Modern Song, for me, because of, the dedication to my dad, and Jeff is very busy. Anyway, finally this past Christmas, he said, I'm going to make it happen. And he called me and said, it's been signed and it's on its way. This is like last month. And I've been waiting, waiting, waiting. And it literally arrived in my building, the FedEx, and it got lost. And I have never, it was never found.
No.
This, it's the craziest thing. It's nobody could believe it. Like, I've never missed a package, but it was the holidays and all these boxes came and it went to the wrong apartment. Anyway, it's the
And
saddest.
you sent a note to all of your neighbors,
Oh, you better believe
everything.
it. I've gone through camera footage. Either somebody's very dishonest, or so the only good thing is Jeff kindly sent me a photo. Apparently, he asked Bob to take a photo of what he wrote to me. And that is what I'm going to frame because it did make me cry and it was beautiful. So that's,
Really?
I have this, I have, I just thought he's going to write his name. But
Right.
he actually, when I don't have it in front of me, but it was very poetic and like the Dylan people would go crazy. It blew my mind.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So your dad passed in 91.
Yeah.
We have the induction into the Hall of Fames. You have the 2012, documentary, aka Doc Pomus.
Right.
You have the album in 1995, the tribute album that you got all these people. I want to ask you how you got them all to do this. It was an incredible, roster of talent. And now, 14 years later or so, you have this, this new, Grammy nominated, collection of 100 of his, demos.
Right.
What happened between 2015 and now? What were you doing? What were you working on? And then how did this bubble up to become the latest addition to the anthology, so to speak?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I just want to say, when you said, how did you get all these people? It was so easy. I wish everything was so easy. Like, I literally, like Lou Reed, for instance, because I keep talking about Lou. I literally asked Lou, and he was almost screaming with joy. And Scott would know that, like
Really?
shrieking laughter when I asked him would he be willing to do it. And then when I told him what songs were available, and I told him this magic moment was available, he couldn't even contain
Right.
himself. So that was like, it was everybody I asked was a,
I mean,
everybody.
Brian Wilson is a notorious recluse, and you got him. He's singing Sweets for My Sweet. I mean, if I would have picked any song, I wouldn't have picked that as a Brian
We didn't
Wilson
pick
song.
any song for any artist. Let me just say
Wow,
that.
he
They
picked
picked their own song. I would just send them like what was available. Like, and then if they didn't
it.
find what they wanted, I'd send a next chunk of songs, So that was how it went. It was never a thing of I'm picking a song for you. I have
Wow,
no
I mean, it's
idea.
interesting what they picked. I mean, you have, people that aren't so easy to please, right? You had the band. I mean, they're not an easy group to please, and they picked the song to do.
Well, my dad was early on friends with Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm. As a matter of fact, Levon and Robbie both talk about how when they came to New York in the very beginning of their career, they came to my dad for songwriting advice. They came to the Brill Building. Robbie, I believe, said he bought him his first pastrami sandwich at. In near, near in Midtown. So,
So I'm sorry, Arnie, just to build on this tribute thing. So the tribute record is a great testament, one of the best expressions of kind of who your dad was. It also brings up in my mind our dear departed friend Hal Wilner. How much did knowing Hal and working with Hal impact what you work on, Sharon?
well, I mean, there's nobody that can even touch anything that Hal did. Hal was a very dear friend. I knew Hal way before Lou knew Hal. We knew Hal because my father's dear friend, Joel Dorn, who was this legendary jazz record producer who also
Right.
produced like Roberta Flack, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, and all this stuff. He lived in Pennsylvania outside of Philly, and Hal Wilner was a huge fan of Joel. And Hal like knocked on Joel's door and knew every record he'd produced, every Rahsaan Roland Kirk, every obscure jazz, and said, "I want to be you." Like I wanted. So Hal was like 17 or 18. So Hal trained under Joel Dorn, and so Hal came to New York and was like under Joel's wing and was always hanging out at my dad's apartment. So Hal was just on the scene. I was doing my own thing. I wasn't like.
Got it.
Occasionally, I would take pictures of Hal or hang out with one of his crazy friends, but I wasn't like really super in the Hal world at that time. He was my father's friend, believe it or not.
And when did you reignite your t friendship with Hal as you started to get into all the different work that you were doing?
I just always knew Hal. Hal was like family, but it was
Got
like
it.
brother that you didn't necessarily hang out with. So I never didn't know Hal,
So what was, from your perspective, knowing your dad better than probably anybody, why did he have such an affinity for black blues artists? I mean, he helped them out during their lives. He was, connected to them. They admired him. People like B.B. King said they couldn't even do justice to the song that your dad sent to him. Why did he have this connection with them, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think he really un identified. For starters, he listened to the radio as a kid. He
Right.
was disabled. He was in bed a lot. He was a voracious reader, and the things he did was listen to jazz on the radio or blues. And when he's told this story so many times, but when he heard Joe Turner,
Joe
that was
Turner, Big
his
Joe
idol,
Turner.
Big Joe Turner. When he heard that voice booming, this Kansas sh City shouter out of the radio, that changed his life. And that's like made him feel like I could be that person. I could be large. When he talked about larger than life, he had that vision that this was something he could do. It spoke to him very profoundly.
The Brill Building is the most iconic music writing building in the world, right? And at a time when your dad, and his partner and then other partners worked out of that building, probably 80% of the great songwriters of all time were, working in there. You obviously spent time in the Brill Building. What was that like? Did you realize at the time what was going on there and what kind of talent was there?
No, I didn't know that at the time. I mean, one thing is people, the Brill Building also was before like my dad's era. It was the Irving Berlin type songwriters as well. So this
Right.
that was the earlier iteration. Ellie Greenwich, all of these people were friends. I will say that. So my dad was very good friends with Ellie Greenwich and Jerry Goffin. They all helped each
Carole
other.
King.
Jerry and
Carole
Mike.
King,
So
yeah.
they were not in the Brill Building. That's a very big misconception. My dad was actually in the Brill Building. Otis Blackwell, his dear, dear friend, was in the Brill Building. Jerry and Mike in the Brill Building, but Carol and Jerry and Phyllis, a lot of Neil Sedaka, all those people were on the next block. So, but they call it
Is
the
that
Brill Building.
right?
Yeah, but they were not actually in the Brill
And
Building.
where would they
They
meet
came in.
for where would they meet for a cup of coffee and where did they go
Oh
to what?
gosh. It's so funny you're asking me this because I was just with this guy, Mark Satloff, 2 nights ago, who has Shorefire Media, and he asked me to be part of a tour in the city of the Brill Building hangouts. I said, okay, we'll do it in April. He has a walking tour of that whole neighborhood.
Does he?
Yeah. So, okay, there was like a bunch of different. Jack Dempsey was the place that they went to. Nate Now. There was a lot of stuff. My dad really was mostly focused in his room at the Forest Hotel.
Right.
Everybody came to him, and he also spent time in the lobby. He was what you call a lobbyist. He loved this. He
He
could.
held court in the lobby, and then late at
Oh,
night, everybody would
100%.
wander in and he would hold court.
Yep.
Yep.
He held court. He would fall asleep in the lobby. It was kind of crazy. He told me he and Phil Spector would actually set up his electric piano and write songs in the lobby. It's hard to even explain how that would be.
From the time that the tribute album came out, the documentary, the tribute album, it was a while
Yeah.
before the you can't hit a square, the
Oh, yeah.
new piece came out. What were you doing? What were you doing during all this time?
Well, okay, so having a child, all of that my daughter was born after my father died, so that was a chunk of my daughter's now 32. But that's not what I, the other thing in that was been that was a phenomenal chapter of my life being a mom, and I'm still very involved with her life. You never stop being a mother. But the other thing is that every project takes years. So like I'm working on so many things for
Right.
years. And besides the archive, which took a few years, I'm working on a movie that's we're so close now to like getting to the place where with really incredible people, but I can't say the names,
Like a
but
biopic. Right.
yeah, but we're trying to make it not quite too linear, but let's just,
Got
no,
it.
I mean
Right.
like really we were waiting for like A-list people, and now we're finally getting that. That took a few years to
Oh, I'm
get
sure. I'm
together, to
sure.
get a script, to get producers, to get all of. So now we're like really trying also to get a Broadway show. I feel like there's a lot of projects that I've been involved with that They just take a long
And you
time.
have good energy for that stuff, right?
Right.
Still, you have good energy for that.
And there's precedent for all of those shows because you can see how successful the show about Bobby Darin is and how successful the Neil Diamond show was. And there's a whole new generation that don't know the songs, the people, their stories. And so
It's
it's
true.
very interesting to them.
Well, I had some good luck and bad luck because so Hal, our beloved Hal, was friends with McGrath, Doug McGrath, who wrote Beautiful. So Hal put me together with Doug, and Doug said, "Don't let anyone tell you that this is not your father's story, is not a musical and a movie." Like he was very encouraging. So that was oh, but. So he was helping me with that, and then he died. It was very shocking. He died very suddenly. Also, I have a partner who was the agent of Marshall Brickman, and Marshall wanted to do a Broadway show about my dad. So we worked together for 2 years because he had written Jersey Boys, and he wrote Annie Hall, among a million other things.
Right. Brilliant.
Marshall is a genius,
Yes.
and his health was deteriorating, so that didn't work. So I went down different paths of like the most A-list people you can ever imagine,
Imagine, sure.
and don't regret any time I lost with them because I learned so much. So I spent like 2 years with Marshall, which I'll never regret it.
What a great
Nothing
experience.
came of it, but it was
Sharon,
amazing.
these
Great experience.
like big projects are there, but in between all of that as well, you're also licensing. There's different
Oh, all
uses.
that stuff. Yeah, that I'm
Talk a
not
little
even
bit about that.
counting that. Well, my husband Will was doing that himself without another company for years, and I wasn't super involved with that. He was doing writing the licensing, doing everything. We had many, many commercials, films. Now with the world of, it's so complicated now with streaming.
Streaming and
So now we're administered by Warner Chappell, and he's still very involved, but it's not. It's too hard to do it all by yourself, but he literally did it all alone for
but
years. We
these,
had.
right, I was gonna say these are sources of income that help
Oh, yeah.
you between the big projects, because it all takes time and money to do these things.
The things that make money are not going to be the big projects, truthfully. The things that make money are the licensing of like commercials or licenses for video games or whatever. Those are the things that make money, believe it or not. The projects like the film is not going to make much. Those are the things that don't make money. Lonely. Oh, I should tell. He's yelling from the other room. No, but we have there's another song that's nominated for a Grammy this year, but that's another topic right now. I'll tell you that later.
So let's talk about this. You're a Grammy nominee for Best Historical Album. You can't hip a square the Doc Bomas songwriting demos. Most of these, kind of historical albums are like greatest hit albums, right? There or whatever. You picked songs that no one had heard before.
A big chunk of these nobody's heard.
There's
The
what,
other
126 of them or something like that?
something like that, but also it's we could do three volumes. We have about 300 more or 200 more, but it's like we picked some favorites, we picked some clinkers, some great songs that nobody's ever heard, and then we like a lot of the Elvis Presley songs. We have those. It's also we don't have demos for a lot of the famous songs. We don't have a demo on Save the Last Dance for Me. We don't have a demo on This Magic Moment. What we have for This Magic Moment on the box is Morty, my father's partner, playing it at a party at my parents' house, just noodling around at the piano. So that's not a demo though.
It's even better than a demo.
Just for fun. And then at that same party, Neil Sedaka was at that party. So he sings Hushabye at the party. And at the same party, Bobby was a good friend of my dad's, and he's there. And then, but he's not on, he doesn't make the cut because he sings his own songs at the party. So it's like, but it was,
Well,
yeah.
I was going to say, some people don't realize that Elvis did 30 plus movies and needed songs for all those movies. And your dad wrote a lot of the songs that were in his movies.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is my dad never met Elvis, which people are always surprised to find. And yeah, so the Colonel, sort of kept Elvis away from the songwriters.
Right.
The only time Elvis did call him on the phone once, and my father famously said he thought it was a prank call, but it was actually Elvis hung up on a lyric, trying to understand the lyric for
Well, and some of his greatest, iconic hits that every, Elvis, impersonator does, Viva Las Vegas and Little Sister and Surrender and Suspicion and Turn Me Loose and all that, your dad wrote.
Well, yeah, thank you. Yeah, he wrote about 30 songs for Elvis. The thing is that the company that he was under contract with, called Hill and Range, which
Right. It was a
they
big
all,
songwriting company.
yes, they handled Elvis Presley music. So
Right.
that helped. So when they were all sent the pitch, everybody put their songs in, and sometimes my dad lucked out and sometimes he didn't.
Right.
No, he got very lucky with Elvis. A song like Surrender, which was, I believe, number one song, that was an assignment from Elvis and the Colonel because they wanted to turn the Italian song Sorrento, he loved
Right.
that song, into a
I
song.
forget which song it was, but your dad wrote a song for Elvis when he was still in the army.
Well, what happened was my parents were in London. I was there with them, and they ran into Lamar Fike, who was a friend of my father's, who was part of the Elvis world in
Entourage.
London, entourage. And Elvis was in Germany in the army at the time. And Lamar said to my dad, Elvis is going to be needing material when he comes out. So they quickly made a demo in London of a song, a bluesy song called A Mess of Blues.
Right.
And shockingly, Elvis recorded it, and it was the B side of It's Now or Never. So
Never.
it was like,
Fantastic.
and that was the first song that Elvis recorded of theirs.
I'd be remiss not to mention a fact that, most families are lucky to have one famous person. Beside you and your dad, you also have your dad's brother, Raoul Felder, who is one of the great, divorce, matrimonial super lawyers who handled Giuliani and Patrick Ewing and, Martin Scorsese and Carl Sagan and Tom Clancy's divorces. I mean, that's an amazing
When you
litany
say handle
of people.
Giuliani, that scares me a bit.
Yeah,
I know,
that's a
but he.
little, we don't, we're not, we're not going to talk about
No,
Giuliani,
but I'm saying there was a whole lot of very fair. I mean,
please.
he was the go-to lawyer of what, the 80s? I mean, everybody that was getting
The
divorced
70s
wanted
and 80s,
70s
and
and 80s.
he's still practicing. He lives a few blocks from me, and I'm very close to him, and I love him to bits. We couldn't be more different in many ways. The same as he and my father couldn't be more different.
Right.
But
But they loved each other, right?
they
They
loved
were
each
good
other
brothers.
100%. My father was very liberal, left wing, you name it. But
Right.
I can't exactly say my uncle, but I love my uncle, and I think he's a fantastic person. And anyway, yeah, he was the guy. He was when I was in graduate school, he let me be the receptionist in his office. I was working my way through grad school, and so he would be like Mike Tyson divorce, you name it. Like he would,
Right.
everybody was coming through that
Coming through,
office.
right. I mean, some amazing people. That's really,
Yeah.
it's unbelievable.
Let's do
It
this,
really is.
Arnie. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Sharon Felder. I mean, we already told you what her title is and all of her different accomplishments. It'll take another 3 minutes. But anyway, we'll be right back with our guest, Sharon Felder, with some final words. Back after this. All right, we are back with our guest, Sharon Felder. And tonight's a big night, Sharon, the Grammys.
I'm
And
excited.
so please tell us,
Yes,
talk
yeah,
about it.
you.
Well, yeah. So the team, the record label that we did this project with, You Can't Hip a Square, is Omnivore, and Cheryl Pavelski and her wonderful team, and Michael Graves of Osiris. He's a phenomenal mastering engineer. So they took these really dusty, funky, shellacked acetate. Messed up acetates and cleaned them and just did all the work. And they literally brought the equipment to New York to do it from California because I didn't want to ship any of these records. So they brought it all in luggage and set up a hotel suite and did this in the hotel this last summer. It was unbelievable, the whole process of how they got digitized the initial batch before they like really finessed it. So that is what we're getting nominated for. And then sadly, her house burned in Altadena like shortly after we worked on this stuff. And then, ironically, also at the Grammys is a song my dad wrote alone, which is a song he's known for called Lonely Avenue. And that
Right.
is individually being nominated, are so funny coincidentally, by John Batiste and Randy Newman have a duet of it. And it's nominated as
Wow.
best roots record, just the
Wow.
best roots performance of the one song.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's and that'll be in the same perform the same event.
It is a Felder Grammys.
Yes, the Felder Grammys.
Possibly.
For our listeners, where would they go? Is there one website they can go to be connected to all of these things and to
Oh my
find them
gosh,
all?
Arnie, we're building a website. We don't have it's just started. It's called Doc Pomus. Oh my God, Will, what's it called? DocPomusOfficial.com. It's brand new. We just are getting it up and running. DocPomusOfficial.com.
Well, great. Our listeners can lock into that. Lastly,
Thank you.
if there was one thing that you want to share with everyone about your dad, if there's one thing that could, sort of capsulize who he was, what he meant to you, what he meant to the world of music, is there something that you could share that would give that kind of snapshot?
Gosh. I mean, my father really was a menschy man. I mean, it's really a cliche to say that, but I mean, Lou Reed used to say he was a man among men, which sounds like a cliche, but I have to really say it's true. I mean, he wasn't perfect, but he was just a good man, and he didn't suffer fools, I will say that.
Right.
And so, like, the title of the box set, You Can't Hip a Square, kind of was something he actually said, because it's
Sure.
like, don't even try to hip a square. You know, it's
Right.
like some people are just not gonna cut it on whatever level. But he was a really great father and a good friend to a lot of people. And I hope the world discovers him more. I mean, we're making this film and other projects, and then this his massive archive. It's really big, and I was inspired by what Laurie did with Lou Reed's archive at the library. That's kind of
Right.
gave me the idea that this could have a home.
Your father, a man among men, I understand what Lou meant by that because I think he looked at him not only as a mentor and as a teacher, but as a source of the truth, right? Remember, you told us that your father said to Lou, consider the source, Lou.
That's
Consider
right.
this, consider
Always.
the source. Like he had an amazing BS detector.
Right,
And
exactly.
maybe I think about it, Dylan, Lou Reed, all of these amazing songwriters, they all have this sensitivity to like the human condition. And
Yeah.
that seems something that really feels like who your father was at the end of the day. It's like he chronicled the human condition.
That's a good way to put it, Scott. Yeah, he was very real, and I think a lot of these talented people like Lou and Dylan, they were always searching themselves. And I think my dad was a source of answers. And also, and he was
Exactly.
the same way with us, me and my brother. Trust me, like, if he thought we were going in a direct, he'd be like, so
He was truthful.
he was
Yes.
truthful.
Sharon, this was great. I so appreciate your time. I know Arnie does too. It was just
Yeah. Thank you.
went
This
by
was
fast.
fun. This
Sharon, this was not to be too cliched, but this was a magic moment for us
Oh,
to
thanks,
review
Scott.
your dad in this way. It's just very heartwarming, and we appreciate you taking your time to share these memories with us.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been
23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.